information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
To border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Lied to
the government believed they were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
Welcome, my friends, to another edition of Media Monarchy. It's episode 54, December 14th, 2007. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. All kinds of news this week. We've got the Krongard brothers and the war's not worth it, and CIA obstructing the 9/11 commission, the Streaking Boys soundtrack, the KBR rape, the torture tapes, the CIA's gift to conspiracy theorists, Muhammad Atta and Abel Danger, the Sears Tower provocateur plot, Iran dumps the dollar, Merck recalls, Naomi Klein, Viacom and torture, NBC refunds, more into the quote-unquote lone gunman shootings. Tons this week. Episode 54 of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network.
Nothing was said of torture in the shed. We cannot find the keys. A shot in the dark. We hardly saw a spark. We're bounding on our knees. We keep us around, drag us through the town. A thank you and a please. Golden boy, give us meaning. Keep our desires away. From dreaming. Slide some scraps under the door, drill holes right in the floor. We got all that we need. Take our clothes and take our shoes. We'll pay our daily dues. Possessions grow like weeds. Don't you look us in the eyes, cut us down the size. Attention turns to greed. Golden boy, give us me. Desires away, keep us from dreaming. Don't you ever let us free, or say myself or me, conformity or creed. Of those who speak reward and soothe the weak, you came and asked to stay. Growing fetuses in wombs, mothers in the tombs, will give our gifts away. Breathe your life into the souls, through the tiny holes, and kneel them down to pray. Golden boy, stop this bleeding. Proper on the ground, kindly hold us down and plant your holy seed.
Oh yes, my friends. That was Mendoza Line, Torture in the Shed. My name's James. You're listening to episode 54 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's December 14th, 2007, coming to you, as always, live Friday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Monday nights at 5 Eastern Time on the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. And as always, you can hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo and iTunes with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And the podcast available anytime thanks to radioforall.net and archive.org. Got tons of news to get into this week. You know, Jodie Foster coming out of the closet and the steroids crisis in sports and Michael Vick and the Led Zeppelin we're not doing any of that shit. We're going to do news that matters. And like I said at the top of the show, it's going to be everything from the Krongard brothers and Ron Paul and Homeland Security visiting the Omaha Mall before the shooting, and more lone gunmen, smoke and mirrors, the latest on 9/11, anti-terror exercises, and a whole lot more. And it's all available at MediaMonarchy.com. Looking at some of the breaking news just now as I pop into the studio live, coming from thinkprogress.org, White House staff exodus continues. Washington Times is reporting President Bush is losing his chief speech writer, William McGurn, and his director of legislative affairs, Candida Wolf. So the rats continue to bail from the ship, or the war wagon, as the ship sinks or the wheels come off. Pick your analogy. We also have another shooting. This at LSU, Louisiana State University. Two graduate students were found shot to death Thursday night in an apartment on the edge of the Louisiana State University campus. No suspects, no nothing. We also have Belarus backing the Russians on the missile defense shield, which we covered a few weeks ago here on MediaMonarchy.com. Belarus says it's ready to, quote, play its role as a Russian ally if the U.S. overrides Moscow's objections and creates a new missile base, or rather new missile bases, in Europe. So that's just a little bit of the breaking news, and I'll keep popping in and checking it out and updating you as we go on this 54th episode of Media Monarchy. But getting to the news I have prepared for you, up first, coming from the AP, New York City shuts down the 9/11 remains sifting facility. The city has closed a facility where debris was sifted for 9/11 victims' remains, but the search won't end until after the World Trade Center site is rebuilt, a city official said Tuesday. Ongoing construction around Ground Zero, including the dismantling of a toxic skyscraper that caught fire in August, could put off a complete search of areas believed to contain human remains for years. This all according to a memo by Deputy Mayor Ed Schuyler. And he says, quote, at no point in the near future would it be prudent to declare this search over. The discovery of more than 80 bones in a manhole at Ground Zero in October 2006 prompted an expanded search of nearby rooftops, manholes, and sewer lines for bone fragments of victims of the terrorist attacks. Hundreds of bones were found beginning in 2005 at the former Deutsche Bank Tower across from the Trade Center site. The city has found 1,772 bones and fragments so far. Seven victims have been identified from bones found in a service road at Ground Zero and on the roof of the Deutsche Bank building. More than 1,100 other Trade Center victims have not been identified from the thousands of remains found after the attack. The medical examiner's office in New York finished its work Monday at a facility that opened last year to hand-sift debris from around Ground Zero, but it will use a tractor trailer and other equipment to continue sifting remains. That sounds disgusting. I didn't know you could sift remains with a tractor trailer. And we'll have more on 9/11, as we always do, as we truck through this episode. But now, jumping to the technocracy, this coming from Digital Trends. AT&T, the good folks at AT&T, the American Telegraph and Telephone Company, they're now offering GPS and RFID child tracking. There's no doubt that schools and teachers can face significant challenges trying to keep track of hundreds of students and assure their safety while simultaneously teaching them something. Now, AT&T is looking to apply technology to the problem, offering a comprehensive child tracking solution for the K-12 education market, combining RFID, radio frequency identification device, and GPS, global positioning system technologies, to enable schools to keep track of school bus locations and speed while simultaneously monitoring events within the vehicles. Quote, our RFID and MRM services help K-12 institutions rapidly deploy end-to-end solutions without significant capital investment, said Ann Rotatori, Vice President of Business Marketing for AT&T, in a statement, "For the first time, school districts can now turn to a network services provider for all their RFID and MRM needs, and that enables them to save money, make the most of their assets and resources, and enhance student safety." It's all about your safety. AT&T envisions the system being used to track in-school assets, like computers, projectors, laptops, and lab equipment, but the company is also pitching the technology as a means to track students and people directly, enforcing attendance and tracking visitors on school grounds, including alerting administrators to people in unauthorized areas. The system is designed to tie in with existing 802.11 Wi-Fi wireless networking solutions and display tracking information via a web-based portal. And you can bet your sweet Bippy that the local cops will be looking at that feed as well. Curiously, nowhere in AT&T's description of the technology does the company mention the privacy rights of students or any ability for students or parents to opt out of such a system. We imagine the company is leaving such policy decisions up to individual schools and districts. Of course, kids being the way they are, they will no doubt come up with a way to circumvent in-school and in-bus RFID tracking within a few minutes of the system being deployed. After all, it took my generation about 30 seconds to acquire the magical hall passes that let us go anywhere we wanted at any time. We have to assume kids these days are at least as clever. We shall see. I also have linked up AT&T's whole white paper on this PDF you can download. I just brought one page with me here. Making schools safer through technology. And they start out by saying our nation's schools are the incubators for our future. Each weekday, tens of millions of young people troop off to primary, secondary, and post-secondary institutions to receive an education, but increasingly the parents who send their children off to school and the teachers who work there are worrying more than just about how to effectively teach and educate their young charges, but also wonder how safe the schools are. And of course, we had the bus stop shooting a few days ago, so I guess we'll have to have surveillance cameras and track and trace at every bus stop in America. Jumping to a terror drill, one of the many. It's happening right now as I speak. It's in California, coming from the Monterey County Herald. Anti-terror exercises set at Presidio. The loud booms coming from the Presidio of Monterey on Friday will likely be an anti-terrorism exercise. Like they say, it will likely be. If you hear explosions, chances are, you know, it might be the thing we're doing. The exercise is scheduled through the day, and the High Street Gate will be closed from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., according to officials from the Defense Language Institute and the Presidio of Monterey. Simulated explosions may be heard, and emergency vehicles may be on site, but all are part of the exercise, said Daisy Bueno, a public affairs officer for the Presidio. Normal operations should not be affected, and office hours are supposed to be normal. And so we'll see. That's going on right now. And I have some links you can read about the Presidio, and you can read about the Defense Language Institute, and some of the links there. We'll send you off down the rabbit hole of one of the former higher-ups at the Defense Language Institute that basically said, we had some of the hijackers, and Bush knew about it, and 9/11 was an inside job, and they swept him away with quickness. So those links are there, and you can go investigate that. And I implore you to do so. So let's jump now to, of course, the Danger Room blog off of Wired. Noah Shackman runs a great blog on Wired. It has all the latest future combat systems, global information grid, military-industrial complex, and all their run-amuckness. So first, Army sets up new office of video games. The U.S. military has been using video games for decades to train its troops. Now, for the first time, the Army has set up a project office just for building and deploying games. No, the Army isn't about to start handing out copies of Halo 3 to troops, TSJOnline.com notes. I haven't seen a game built for the entertainment industry that fills a training gap, said Colonel Jack Miller, director of the services Training and Doctrine Command, TRADC, which we've gone over here before, Project Office for Gaming, or TPO Gaming. Instead, the new office, part of the Army's Kansas-based National Simulation Center, and you can go check out their page, will focus on using video game graphics to make those dull military simulations more realistic and better looking. TPO Gaming is also starting work on a toolkit that would let soldiers, quote, build and customize their own training scenarios without waiting for a contractor to do it for them. The Marine Corps has already pioneered this concept, of course, with Virtual Battle Space 2, an adaptation of the Armed Assault first-person shooter. The game is one of the candidates under consideration for the Army Toolkit, but by then it won't exactly be cutting edge. The kit may not deploy until as late as 2015. By then, DARPA's made-to-order simulation tool could already be in the works, too, anyway. And there's links for you there to read about DARPA's sim tool. TPO Gaming is hardly the Army's first foray into the field. 5 years ago, the service deployed the America's Army Shoot 'em Up to recruit potential soldiers. The game proved so popular, it became a military training tool. The Army has also poured millions into the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California to use Hollywood know-how to develop next-generation sims. But while some military offices encourage video game development, others are looking to crack down on the games troops play. Again, TSJOnline.com observes that the U.S. Defense Department's regulations on installing video games within one's workstation can be summed up in one word. Don't. Or at least don't do it without first submitting the software for an elaborate testing and accreditation process. And so, there's links in there. You can check out America's Army. I may have even touched on that before because, of course, the military and video games come up all the time. And we may dip our toes back into that in a little bit with a clip that I have. But one more, or rather, no, there's two more from Wired and all this insanity. This one's jumping back to 2003, May 20th again, Noah Shachtman, again, the Danger Room blog. A spy machine of DARPA's dreams. It's a memory aid, a robotic assistant, an epidemic detector, an all-seeing, ultra-intrusive spying program. The Pentagon is about to embark on a stunningly ambitious research project designed to gather every conceivable bit of information about a person's life, index all the information, and make it searchable. What national security experts and civil libertarians want to know is, why would the Defense Department want to do such a thing? The embryonic, life log would dump everything an individual does into a giant database. Every email sent or received, every picture taken, every web page surfed, every phone call made, every TV show watched, every magazine read, all of this and more would combine with information gleaned from a variety of sources like, a GPS transmitter to keep tabs on where that person went, audiovisual sensors to capture what he or she sees or says, and biomedical monitors to keep track of the individual's health. This gigantic amalgamation of personal information could then be used to, quote, trace the threads of an individual's life to see exactly how a relationship or events developed, according to a briefing from the Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency. And then, of course, someone with access to the database could retrieve a specific thread of past transactions or recall an experience from a few seconds ago or many years ago by using a search engine interface. And that article goes on, and it's frightening. And again, that's back 2003. And like so many of these things, that by the time they're telling us about them, they're 10 years ahead anyway. This one, however, is December 10th, dated. One more time from the Danger Room blog. New document reveals military mysteries powers. And there's a nice, nice, green, disturbing photo of HAARP. H-A-A-R-P. For years, no military program has sparked more fevered speculation from conspiracy theorists than the mysterious High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HAARP. And for years, the Pentagon has been poo-pooing speculation that the enormous collection of transmitters, radars, and magnetometers in Alaska was some sort of superweapon. But it turns out, the conspiracy theorists may not have been entirely off base after all. Of course not, which of course they don't cite in this article, but Dr. Nick Begich and all his work on HAARP, and I've linked up, and you can watch Angels Don't Play This HAARP and Weather Wars and Holes in Heaven. Back to the article. Since its inception, there's been a huge range of opinion on what HAARP actually does. Everything from a giant mind control facility to space nuke countermeasures to weather controller to an ionosphere boiling mad science experiment to the mother of all pork projects has all been suggested. But now that the program is actually up and running, military managers say the electronics array has much more benign use. HAARP's main job is to produce radio waves to probe the ionosphere, an Air Force Research Laboratory officer said in October, which is true up to a point. A drive-by Clifford Stone on the X-Files-esque Uber site above Top Secret, which is sometimes kind of shady, to use the Freedom of Information Act to turn up UFO-related documents has led to the release of a fascinating report, HAARP Research and Applications, with a link. It's from the Air Force Research Laboratory and Office of Naval Research, and it lays out the uses the military sees for HAARP. Turns out the Pentagon wants some military bang from their buck from this program. So now HAARP can actually perform a lot of militarily important functions, all involving the interactions of radio waves with the high atmosphere, and ionosphere, and magnetosphere. The document points out that on the higher frequency end, VHF and UHF, oh, that's a long word. Sorry, it stuttered me. On the higher frequency end, VHF and UHF, transionospheric propagation is a ubiquitous element of numerous civilian and military communication systems, surveillance, and remote sensing systems. In other words, messing with the ionosphere means you can shut down VHF radio, TV, and radio, rather radar, signals at will. As radio hams know, which we went over last week, the reflection and refraction effects on the ionosphere make a huge difference to long-range radio reception, and HAARP provides the only means of influencing that. Another interesting feature is how HAARP can influence the auroral electrodynamic circuit, a natural flow of electricity which ranges from 100,000 to a million megawatts, equivalent to 10 to 100 large power plants. Messing with the electrical properties of the ionosphere means some of this tremendous flow of power can be changed at the flick of a switch. In effect, the natural flow can be modulated to create a gigantic low-frequency radio transmitter, which is extremely interesting, of course, to military types. ELF, extremely low-frequency waves, can be used for submarine communications and for probing the planet. And because of the ways that they propagate, HAARP can cover a significant fraction of the Earth. And some have said, perhaps, break it in half. Like Tesla. HAARP can also induce precipitation and energetic particles in the ionosphere, which could impact the operation and lifespan of satellites. While this is mainly about protecting satellites from particles from solar flares or nuclear explosions, the phrasing suggests that it might be able to have subtle negative impact on satellites as well. At the high-frequency range, HAARP also has some useful tricks, including being able to enhance ground-to-ground and satellite-to-ground links that would otherwise be marginal or absent. Its ability to create a radio reflective layer means it can create new over-the-horizon capabilities for radio and radar systems. All in all, it's a setup that can do a lot more than just basic research. And while this may not seem much compared to weather modification, remember that these are just the capabilities they're willing to make public, like we just said. So yeah, I implore you to go read about HAARP. H-A-A-R-P. Shifting gears, back to 9/11, back to the media, back to video games. This coming from the Jersey Journal at NJ.com. Outrage over 99-cent game based on 9/11. Crass commercialism of the holidays isn't new, but it may have reached a new low at a Bayonne dollar store that offers a game that exploits one of the worst tragedies in the history of the United States. The September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center, where more than 2,600 people were killed, has been reduced to a 99-cent handheld video game in which President Bush fights Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. It's being sold at the 99-cent depot in the Twin City Shopping Mall on Garfield Avenue. The packaging of the game console, which features Bush versus bin Laden and three other games, includes an anti-Semitic caricature of Bush as a white bird holding an assault rifle opposite a smiling bin Laden holding an airplane in one hand and a bomb in the other. The packaging also depicts Bush and bin Laden as cartoon boxers. Quote, "It is so funny, let's play together," reads the package, which also has images of the World Trade Center, the World Financial Center in Lower Manhattan, and the U.S. Capitol. When Carl Cappy of Jersey City and Marianne Russell of North Bergen saw the game on the shelf Tuesday night, they were outraged. "My first reaction was to say, what are you guys, crazy? That should not be a joke or a game," Russell said. "Why would it even come into this country?" She wants the game taken off the shelves, of course. where about 25 copies remained today. I'm sure they're all snapped up now. But an acting manager at the store who refused to give his name yesterday defended the right to sell the game, saying the U.S., quote, is a free country. Huh. The price on the package says $39.99, but shoppers weren't snatching them up yesterday, even with the $39 discount. Ain't Bin Laden bad? Why would you advertise a bad man? Said Jesse Baskerville of Jersey City. I wouldn't let my child play with that. Bush would lose anyway. He still can't find Bin Laden. Which is hilarious that she's outraged about it. And then also goes, well, yeah, dumbass can't find him anyway. Ironically, here's the kicker. Ironically, the game, which the package says was, of course, made in China, was on a shelf near the Support the Troops stickers. How can you sell that in the same row? Cappy asked. The store's acting manager said the game is not an endorsement of terrorism and that shoppers can decide whether or not to buy it. I don't believe in Santa, but I'm selling them, so what does that make me? You gotta remember, it's a free country. And there's a nice... I do have a photo posted up of that, so you can see the... I don't know where they get the anti-Semitic caricature of Bush, but you can see him as the dove with the gun. Jumping now to the timesonline.co.uk, Kurt Nimmo also has a report on this up on truthnews.us. French speed camera saboteurs demand ransom to halt the attacks. So basically, there's an anti-radar group that's destroying French speed cameras. So, Dateline Paris, French anti-terrorist police are hunting a guerrilla organization that's blowing up speed cameras and demanding a ransom from the state. Police are taking seriously claims from the Nationalist Revolutionary Army faction that is responsible for the destruction of 6 radar installations on roads in Paris over the last 6 months. The latest attempted attack was on Tuesday on a motorway close to the village of Ballet-en-France, 20 miles north of the capital. The device, consisting of a bundle of explosives and a timer, did not detonate. It was spotted by road maintenance teams and defused after police closed the motorway for 5 hours. The FNAR, which also calls itself the National Anti-Radar Front, which curiously gets you 0 Google hits other than this article and Kurt Nimmo's article and probably mine coming up behind it. The National Anti-Radar Front is reported to be demanding a significant sum of money to halt the attacks, as well as tax cuts and less rigorous enforcement of the laws on the roads. The group sent its demands to the Interior Ministry in October. Worded in the grandiose jargon of 1970s revolutionary groups, it complained about the oppression of the owner state, which robs its citizens. The police said they did not know if they were dealing with one person or a group, but either way, this is dangerous stuff. And there's a nice photo that you can see of one of the cameras kind of knocked over. Kind of looks like they just chopped it over like a redwood. Moving on now, but still speaking of surveillance, there's a film that opens today in select cities, which is pretty much a euphemism for New York and LA. And it's called Look. Now, I have the story posted up under what I realize is a bit of a deceptive headline. New film Look. Made of surveillance footage, purports to be made of surveillance footage. That's not exactly true. It's not of surveillance footage, but it's a film that uses nothing but surveillance cameras for the entire film. Now, in some of their marketing and on their website, you can see lots of other real surveillance camera footage, but I don't believe that plays that much into the film. Still interesting nonetheless, and let's read a little bit about it, coming from Alternet, with... what safeguards exist to make sure highlights of your ass are not making it onto the most viewed list on YouTube. Look, which has already won major kudos on the film festival circuit and will be in theaters this Friday, that's today, is sure to be a thought-provoking and controversial film. It purports to be made entirely out of surveillance footage shot without the knowledge of the people involved. Like I said, that's not exactly true. According to the film's director, Adam Rifkin, 37, he says it's legal to cut out video cameras, or rather, legal to out video cameras in public dressing rooms. Rifkin seeks to provoke audiences to ask themselves who is watching this footage and who is keeping it safe from public distribution, who has access to it, and for how long. And again, what safeguards exist to make sure highlights of your ass aren't on the most viewed list on YouTube. There's a couple links to read a little more about this. There is a review on the New York Times webpage. It says, at times, it seems video surveillance is omnipresent in America. And Adam Rifkin spends the better part of 2 hours asserting just that in his fiction feature Look. This motion picture gains a historical footnote as the first U.S. mainstream movie to depict events solely through the eyes of surveillance video cameras. The preponderance of action unfurls in San Fernando Valley offices, stores, and shopping malls, where we witness security camera footage of character interactions and events that would likely never occur if the perpetrators knew they were being watched.
You're not wearing any underwear.
Stop. I'm supposed to be Madge.
Angry sex is good shit.
Are you stalking me or what?
You would like that, wouldn't you? Did anybody see?
No, he's gonna get caught.
I won't suspect anything.
I'm your mother's friend.
No. My little girl was sitting right here.
My husband found out, he'd kill us both.
I made a mistake.
She came on to me so many
times. You're the grown-up.
You're under arrest for sexual assault.
Somebody help me!
I swear not to tell a soul.
You should have known!
No!
It's all you, Julia. She made the whole thing up. Come on, you know I would never do anything like that.
They have you on tape.
That's the audio from the trailer from the new film Look, which, like I said, opens in quote-unquote select cities today, and you can read more about it on MediaMonarchy.com. Jumping now, we're going to dive in a bit to all these mass shootings. It's the latest craze, don't you know? So this first from Kurt Nimmo, truthnews.us. This going to December 9th, this last Sunday. Lone gunman kills cult members in Colorado. Now, this is the early report, and this story has changed, as of course we mentioned, and of course, as you should notice, that these stories always change as the first news spills out, and as things change, and the new official story comes into place. So this is the breaking news report coming from Kurt Nimmo. A gunman walked into a training center dormitory for young Christian missionaries early Sunday and opened fire, killing two of the center's staff members and wounding two others, reports The Guardian. The shooting happened at about 12:30 a.m. at the Youth with a Mission Center, police spokeswoman Susan Medina said. About 45 people were evacuated from the dormitory in the Denver suburb. Now to Kurt Nimmo. At this time, there are few details as the gunman escaped without a trace. However, his target has a few rather odd associations. According to Nat Mayone Person and Robert Parsons, Youth with a Mission is a CIA front group involved in espionage missionary work, particularly in developing nations. According to Rick Ross, Youth with a Mission was founded by a California Assemblies of God minister, Lauren Cunningham, in 1961. The organization reportedly has claimed, from 1982, more than 1,500 long-term and 10,000 short-term missionaries. Youth with a Mission, with numerous bases internationally, discipleship training schools throughout the United States and outside America, is one of the largest evangelistic missionary organizations in the world. Certainly millions of dollars flow through its accounts yearly. Youth with a Mission does have substantial influence within the evangelical Christian community. Before it was bankrupted by the Church of Scientology, the Cult Awareness Network stated that Youth with a Mission has many elements of a destructive cult, specifically the authoritarian control by the elders over its members. Youth with a Mission is vehemently anti-Catholic and pro-Reconstructionist. That is, founder Lauren Cunningham believes in replacing democracy with a fundamentalist Protestant theocracy, writes Joseph Cannon of the great blog cannonfire.blogspot.com. Although the Person and Parsons do not bother to provide additional information on their accusation, it's interesting to note that filmmaker David Lauren Cunningham, son of Lauren Cunningham, Youth with a Mission founder, was allowed to film at CIA headquarters in Langley for his feature ABC series, The Path to 9/11. Basically, that slick propaganda piece starring Harvey Keitel, Patricia Heaton, and Donnie Wahlberg, and based on the official whitewash commission fairy tale. Is Bush and the CIA behind the controversial ABC News documentary, The Path to 9/11, which blames Clinton for the 9/11 attack? It looks like it might be. Mark Perkle rants. Now here's the quote. The movie's director, David Lauren Cunningham, is an evangelical nutcase and the son of the guy who started the Christian cult Youth with a Mission. The movie producers had unusual access to CIA headquarters to make this film. Seems to be a lot of people on the web connecting the dots, but it looks like this is a CIA propaganda film that was produced by the Bush administration to change the outcome of the upcoming congressional elections, which we went over the path to 9/11 last year, right before said congressional elections. Back to the article and the quote. Besides, who came up with the $40 million to produce this lie? We may never know for sure, but it's probably us taxpayers through one of those black budgets that funds projects like this and CIA torture camps. As it turns out, Cunningham the Younger is connected to the neocon network, specifically David Horowitz, the former Marxist with connections to documented CIA asset Richard Mellon Scaife. Quote, early on, Cunningham had recruited a young Iranian-American screenwriter named Cyrus Nowrasteh, N-O-W-R-A-S-T-E-H, to write the script for his 9/11 fantasy project. Not only is Cyrus an outspoken conservative, he's also a fervent member of the emerging network of right-wing people burrowing into the film industry with ulterior sectarian political and religious agendas. Like Cunningham, replace conservative and right wing with neocon and you have a more accurate idea of the mechanics. And as the aforementioned Cannon Fire notes, Youth with a Mission is connected to Agape Airlines. Agape operates at the world infamous Venice Airport where Muhammad Atta trained. A pilot named Mark Mickerts flies for Agape, the same pilot was Atta's flight instructor. Once again, we're presented with a series of supposed coincidences surrounding yet another apparent lone gunman mass murder scenario. Of course, at this time, the shooting outside of Denver appears to be a random act of violence or possibly an act of vengeance on the part of a former Youth with a Mission member. Now, we mentioned Scientology a moment ago, bankrupting the cult awareness network, CAN. But here's something from Press TV, and this has been bubbling up more and more and more lately. It kind of tied into the Tom Cruise film from a few months ago that they were trying to shoot in Germany, but they kicked them out. Germany's attack on Scientology, this coming from Press TV. German top security official Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble has accused the U.S.-based Creed of Scientology of being anti-democratic. The DPA reported last Sunday that Schäuble had agreed to step up police surveillance of the Scientology organization, which is recognized in several other countries as a church. In an interview with the newspaper Bild am Sonntag, Schäuble said it was important to educate the public about Scientology, but he rejected civil liberties concerns about the surveillance. Scientology is working on obtaining political power and influence in Germany, he said, charging that the group was hostile to constitutional principles. They want to deactivate essential basic and human rights such as human dignity and the right to equal treatment, he said of the group, which is estimated to have 6,000 German members. The Creed was established by U.S. science fiction writer the late L. Ron Hubbard. The United States has repeatedly criticized Germany over the surveillance, saying it breaches freedom of religion. That's hilarious. And there's lots of good links in there for you, like the Google search I ran for you and linked up Hubbard, plus Crowley, plus Manson, plus Parsons. Let's jump now to Vanity Fair. Their new issue, the January 2008 issue, showed up on newsstands last week. And when I'm at work late at night and I take my lunch break, I usually grab whatever magazines are new on the shelf and flip through them, looking for anything interesting. And did I find it? Boy, did I. In the new Vanity Fair issue, any article that jumps out and mentions Beck, Scientology, and 9/11 conspiracy theories, I was all over. So there's an article called The Golden Suicides, and the full article is now up on VanityFair.com. It wasn't up for the first several days. The magazine was on the stands, but it is now. It's a long 8-page article, and it was about a story that I had never heard of, but it is recent. When Teresa Duncan, 40, took her own life on July 10th, followed a week later by her boyfriend Jeremy Blake, 35, their friends were stunned and the press was fascinated. What had destroyed this glamorous couple stars the New York's multimedia art world, still madly in love after 12 years. And it's a story written by someone named Nancy Jo Sales. And it basically goes into their paranoia and their obsession with 9/11 conspiracy theories and their involvement with Beck and Scientology. Now, what I'm going to do is, I'm going to play a clip of myself. I know, how self-serving. I called up my good friends Doug and Michael of BlacklistedNews.com and Thought-Criminal.org on their show, The Intel Strike Report, the other night. They do a show every night on TruthNet Radio, TNRLive.com, and I actually called up to go into the Golden Suicides article.
Well, I was just going to say, I was on your website. I just clicked on it. MediaMonarchy.com is where you can check out all of James's articles. He does a show as well that we'll definitely let him plug. But there's an outrage over this 99-cent game based on 9/11. This comes from the New Jersey Journal. Crass commercialism of the holidays isn't new, but it may have reached a new low at the Bayon of the Dollar store that offers a game that exploits one of the worst tragedies in the history of the United States. For 99 cents, you can get this game. It's it has a picture of Bush's head with angel wings and an AK, and it's versus. It looks like a spy versus spy, if you're familiar with Mad Magazines. It's spy versus spy logo. Left is a picture of George Bush with the army helmet, and he's got a dove wing body. He's kind of a Pegasus, if you will, of freedom, and he's going after Osama bin Laden. That's pretty wild stuff. I'll definitely have to post that after the show. I mean, what do you think about this, James?
Well, it was funny because I think I came across that article as you guys were talking about the Army training video game and stuff from the Danger Room Wired blog.
Right.
So it's just, I mean, it's nothing new. I mean, I imagine we're all probably about the same age. I'm 30. I mean, we grew up, I played a ridiculous amount of 8-bit Nintendo, but I feel like a lot of those games then, I mean, it was Kid Icarus and Zelda and stuff like that, and it was never these really, you know, literally military industrial complex related and design games where you're just
shoot them in the head. I mean, shoot them in the head, throwing grenades on people. I mean that's the Army's plan. I mean, you know, they're making a new game. They already made America's Army and some other stuff that they made, like Full Spectrum Warrior. But I mean, you know, there's a whole generation of people who you know, who have been trained by these video games to kill without any remorse whatsoever.
Yeah, it's just, funny. This is really if you look back, and we talk about this every once in a while, the old Bugs Bunny episodes that we grew up on, because I'm 30 years old as well. And Mike, how old are you? You're what? You're only
33.
33, you old man, you. But, we were all raised on very, I guess, low-level propaganda. And now, I mean, it's just light years ahead. And, you know, this is probably one of the lighter little pieces of propaganda out there. And I don't know, this kind of, looking at this, and you definitely need to go and check this out at MediaMonarchy.com, this outrage over this 99-cent game. It's just the picture of the tab. It really reminds me of some, you know, World War II type propaganda, you know, where you have Ike on one side and you have the Nazis on the other, something to that effect. But it really amazes me that, you know, that these video games today, I mean, I used to like a lot of racing games, and I played those 8-bit games as well, and I still do today. I'm a big fan of Qbert, and, you know, and for the most part, I don't really like these new, really high-tech virtual games, because I just don't, even if I was really into them, and some of them are kind of fun, it just takes so much dedication and time out of your day. I mean, I know people, we were talking about this last night, that spend, you know, 20 to 30 hours a week playing them, but the sophisticated propaganda and training, and not only training, but these huge events the Army holds for these video game conventions that, you know, you see all this Army advertising in, is really a recruitment tool, and it's really scary. It's a far cry from those days of Zelda.
Absolutely. The kicker on this article, too, is funny. It says, ironically, the game, which, of course, was made in China, was also on the shelf near the Support the Troops stickers.
That were also made in China, I'm sure. We have on the line James from MediaMonarchy.com. He also does a show. Why don't you tell him a little bit about your show there, James?
I do a once-a-week, two-hour show on a local station here called the Portland Radio Authority. Interestingly enough, the station started out as it had an internet stream, but it was also a pirate or LPFM that operated in the city, and it got to be slowly more and more popular to where the Oregonian, the main city newspaper here, wanted to do a story on them, and they said, absolutely, that'd be great. You know, we love the coverage and everything, just don't say where we are. Story comes out, and what does it say? Exactly where they are. Next day, knock, 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 FCC shows up with the cease and desist. So we've got the cease and desist order frames hanging up in the studio, but the stream still exists online at praradio.org. So I do the show live there Friday mornings at 10 Pacific time, and then actually Rob and the good folks at the Revere Radio Network rerun the show for me Monday afternoons. So that's awesome. I've been doing the show for about a year, and it basically was just the outgrowth of doing MediaMonarchy.com for the last 2 years. You know, it's basically I go on each week and do the backstory of all the news from the previous week.
Right, yeah, and you do it to cool music. If you go to MediaMonarchy.com, you can always get the podcast and download them. I do. I take James with me to work at least once a week, and we jam out and listen to the stories. He covers a lot of the same news that we do, and he's a splinter cell of this news network that we have grown, and he's always been a great friend of BlacklistedNews.com. Always, linking back, and we reciprocate that as well.
So that's my man Doug at BlacklistedNews.com. I called up earlier, and they were kind enough to let me hog their show for 45 minutes, and they posted it up and posted a link to me and everything, so I appreciate that. So go check that out at IntelStrike.com. However, I guess I brought the wrong clip because I was going to play the part where I was talking about the Golden Suicides article that I was reading before I played that clip. But we talked about the video game parts. But it's all there. But I want to jump back to the Golden Suicides and read the one part that jumped out at me. The article written by, like I said, the woman named Nancy Jo Sales is all coincidentally the ex-wife of Father Frank Morales out of New York and of the New York 9/11 truth scene. But this part jumped out. Speaking of Father Morales, he offered to contact his friend Alex Jones about doing a Scientology show on his nationally syndicated radio program, which specializes in government secrets and conspiracies. Jeremy Blake liked the idea. In January, he had sent someone an email promoting Alex Jones as a colorful Texas populist who has hipster credibility. It was through Jones' show that he had become familiar with the 9/11 truth movement and its questioning of the U.S. government's so-called official story. He had emailed friends about this, too. He now became a semi-regular attendee at the Sunday night 9/11 truth meetings at St. Mark's Church, which Morales oversees. Morales said he was talking about doing art around 9/11 truth. So that's a long story. It's a long, ugly story. I also have posted up a more speculative and conspiratorial take on the Jeremy Blake and Teresa Duncan suicides. This coming from Alex Constantine. He has an article on his page on Alex Constantine's anti-fascist research bin. He has an article called The Murder of Teresa Duncan, Jim County, Rupert Murdoch, the CIA, cable industry, mind control, drugs, and political assassination. And I brought a couple pages of that with me, but it's too mind-bending to get into, so I'm going to keep moving on. Staying on bizarre murders and shootings, once again, Kurt Nemo, truthnews.us. This is what I didn't know last week when we covered the Omaha Mall shooting. What we did cover, of course, was the possibility of a second gunman and someone in military fatigues being arrested, and that photo is up on MSNBC and MediaMonarchy.com. This came out a couple days later. Ministry of Homeland Security visited the Omaha Mall before the massacre.
President Bush extended his sympathy to the families of those murdered. He coincidentally had been in Omaha just hours before the shootings began. In the city of Omaha today, there was what everyone said was shock. We learned today that shortly before the shooting, a Homeland Security employee visited the West Roads Mall to talk with officials about the mall's security. Airports and sports arenas have tightened security considerably since 9/11, but malls have been reluctant to do so.
And they probably won't have much of a choice now. So that's a clip from ABC. So let's break this down. Before the shooting at the Omaha Mall, which of course has the possibility of a second gunman, Homeland Security visited the mall hours before the shooting took place to talk about security. Meanwhile, Bush was in Omaha giving a speech about mental health, in which an hour later, a couple hours later, someone who has, of course, mental health problems and was on psychotropic drugs and bounced around from facilities and homes just happened to go on a rampage. I talk about this and more, and here's my other self-serving, self-referential moment. I guess I had a little bit of extra time in the last week, because I also called up Alex Ansari on his show, Outside the Box, that he does Saturday mornings on WTPRN, We the People Radio Network.
And with no further ado, we have James on the line. James, nice to talk to you.
Hey, what's up, brother? It's James.
Media Monarchy?
Jump. Yep, MediaMonarchy.com.
Cool.
I wanted to jump back to the shooting real quick.
Yeah.
It came out even during the day of. Of course, there were early reports of a second person arrested wearing military fatigue. That's pretty much disappeared from the news. And also, today, Kurt Nimmo just put up on truthnews.us that Homeland Security coincidentally visited the mall before the shooting, because Bush was in town. So Chertoff gave some report where they mentioned that Homeland Security went to go talk to security at the mall. And there's also an ABC quick report up.
Okay, we're going to bring up Mo as well, James, if you don't mind, because he just called the show the other day and he was saying the exact same thing. Real briefly, Mo, rehash what you were saying the other day about the shooting.
Oh, yes. He's right, too. I saw it on the KOVA.com, and they took it off within 20 minutes. And I'm sorry that I couldn't put it on my Microsoft, and I can send it to you. But, yes, he's right. I am right, too.
James, you heard what Mo had said. Break down real quickly what you think's happening here, that they have some sort of Manchurian candidate or they have the wrong guy. It looks like, sounds like... We don't really know who did this now.
That's what I think. And with a lot of these things, it seems like there's so much smoke and mirrors that it's difficult to point to any one thing. I would definitely always tend to believe that there's some sort of Manchurian candidate that, you know, we'll always find out has been involved in some kind of psychiatric care and been bounced around from different homes. There's also a good report, not on the sort of conspiratorial end, and that's, I think, why I like his work. There's a guy named Warren Coleman who wrote a book called The Copycat Effect that goes into a lot of basically the media's discussion of events like these that, of course, lend to making them happen again and again. He points out that this shooting happened one calendar month to the day after the Finnish school shooting, which happened one calendar month to the day of the, I believe, Salt Lake City shooting.
This is weird. Okay.
We have a three-month cycle now of shootings. There was also reports of shots fired in a Pennsylvania mall yesterday.
Okay, I'd like to definitely get those dates, and we'll go ahead and see if I can consolidate that information. Thanks, James. This is strange because...
I'll get off here and let you wrap up the show. I do have this and more up on the page on MediaMonarchy.com. If you need it, you can go grab it there.
So and with Virginia... With Virginia Tech, there was a DARPA facility that was nearby that somebody discovered online. It's written about that. You found it through Google Earth, and they took it down. And that was strange because there was also some weird stories about Virginia Tech as well about the possibility of more than one shooter because of the amount of distance that guy covered just by himself with his little gun.
Exactly, which of course is the same thing that happens in RFK's murder and JFK's murder. There's always more shots fired than one.
This kid was a super serial assassin. This kid was a super... He killed people the way some cops can.
Exactly.
Very interesting,
I'm going to jump off here. Thanks, brother. I really appreciate
James.
So that's me talking to Alex Ansari last Saturday on his show, Outside the Box, on We the People Radio Network. Now jumping to ABC News, as I mentioned, of course, mall safety. Shopping for safety solution at U.S. malls. Despite last Wednesday's massacre at an Omaha, Nebraska shopping mall, one day after the incident, it was business as usual at many other shopping centers around the country. You think about it, you know, but life goes on, doesn't it? Said one mother shopping with her daughter. But some shoppers told ABC News they were afraid. I'd like to see more security people around so that it's safer for holiday shoppers, said another woman. Malls face a difficult dilemma in balancing security interest without scaring off customers. The joy of holiday time is the ability to get out in public, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said Thursday. And speaking of all this, and one of the ways that we know that an Homeland Security officer visited the mall before the shooting was that in a press conference that I believe was about actually the Real ID Act, Chertoff was asked about the Omaha shooting, and he mentioned, oh, coincidentally, we had one of our guys go there, I think. So that press release is up from the Department of Homeland Security, DHS.gov, and that's there. And, of course, it would be interesting, you know, you should look up that Chertoff, I believe in Russian, means son of the devil. Shifting gears, though, AP reports that Syria is blocking access to Facebook. Syrian authorities have blocked Facebook, the popular internet hangout, over what seems to be fears of Israeli infiltration of Syrian social networks on the net, according to residents and media reports. Residents of Damascus said they have not been able to enter Facebook for more than 2 weeks. An AP reporter got a blank page when he tried to open Facebook's homepage last Friday from the Syrian capital. Syrian officials were not available for comment last Friday because of the Muslim weekend, but some reports have suggested that the ban was intended to prevent Israeli users from infiltrating Syrian social networks. Lebanon's daily As-Safir reported that Facebook was blocked on November 18th. It said the authorities took the step because Israelis have been entering Syria-based groups. Human rights groups have regularly criticized Syrian authorities for blocking opposition sites and internet sites critical of President Bashar Assad's government. Former President Hafez Assad's death in 2000 after 3 decades of authoritarian rule raised hopes of a freer society under his British-educated son and successor, but the younger Assad cracked down on political opponents and human rights activists, putting many of them in jail. And so that's another example of just the widespread authoritarian censorship police state crackdown on the streets and on the internet. Jumping to Listening Post. This is a fun one. Billboard blasts passersby with audio advertisement. Walk by the billboard for the new A&E show Paranormal State on Prince Street in Manhattan, and you could find yourself targeted by a narrow beam of sound projected from the ad using technology from Holosonics, HOLOSONICS.com, which specializes in creating audio spotlights that are audible only to the person whose cranium they hit. Not even earplugs will keep them out because apparently it vibrates within the head. According to Ad Age, the voice says, "Who's there? Who's there? It's not your imagination." The president and founder of Holosonics, Joe Pompei, denies that his technology is utterly annoying and wrong. If that were his goal, he said he would have used a loudspeaker instead of an audio spotlight. If you set up a loudspeaker on the top of a building, everybody's going to hear that noise. But if you're only directing that sound to a specific viewer, you're never going to hear a neighbor complaint from street vendors or pedestrians. The whole idea is to spare other people. Yeah, that's the whole idea. Sure it is. Speaking of media and ad space, this coming from LouRockwell.com. I haven't fully investigated this, but this is a doozy. Mitt Romney to buy Clear Channel. What would it cost to buy the support of just about every nationally syndicated neocon talk show host in America? About $19.5 billion, which is what Mitt Romney's private equity firm Bain Capital, B-A-I-N Capital, and Thomas H. Lee Partners have agreed to pay in a leveraged buyout agreement with Clear Channel, the largest radio station owner in the country. Clear Channel owns over 1,100 full-power AM, FM, shortwave radio stations, 12 radio channels on XM, and more than 30 television stations in the United States. That, of course, doesn't mention all their billboards and concert venues and more. Premier Radio Networks, which is the largest syndication company in the United States, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Clear Channel and is home to Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and many others. Sean Hannity recently signed a large multi-market contract with Clear Channel as well. And now there's a quote from an anonymous email to Chris Brunner, who wrote this report for LouRockwell.com. I'll bet those hosts won't reveal that conflict of interest, but it's worth noting when you hear them begin hyping Romney, which has already begun. A lot of GOP supporters will support whomever they are told to support, so be prepared for a big push for Romney. On the bright side, Romney has more vulnerabilities than Rudy, based on his record. Look at this as the GOP establishment doing us a favor. Rich men can bankroll their own campaigns, a la John Kerry. But it takes a special breed to use investors' money to buy entire networks that can operate as passive wings of a presidential campaign. And I, of course, have linked up all of Clear Channel's nefarious deeds, and you can read about all their repeat songs and all their commercial breaks and all the songs they tried to remove from playlists after 9/11, and of course the Dixie Chicks and their use of non-local DJs and voice tracking and their rejection of an anti-war billboard and all that. Sticking on the media, this coming from Reuters, NBC, the National Broadcasting Corporation, refunds advertisers as ratings plunge. Fourth-ranked broadcaster NBC has quietly begun reimbursing advertisers an average of $500,000 for each. $500,000 each for failing to reach guaranteed ratings levels. The first time a network has taken such a step in years, media buyers said. Networks usually offer make goods and have a link to an advertising glossary that you can read about what make goods are, but they're basically free advertising slots in the event of such ratings shortfalls. But NBC has none to give. In fact, no broadcast network has much ad inventory left between now and the year's end, except for perhaps a handful of units the week before Christmas and New Year's, but that doesn't do much for advertisers chasing the holiday shoppers. CBS, ABC, and Fox are also doling out make goods, primarily for the first quarter. They've blamed softness on a new ratings formula, but media agencies disagree, and none of the networks would comment. The network's problems emerged even before the Writers Guild of America went on strike November 5th. The networks had enough first-run shows to get them through November, and repeats and replacement programming will not begin in earnest until January, when their problems will likely start to worsen. And, of course, you gotta look at this on the bright side, that a lot of people are gonna turn away from those reruns and bullshit and turn to where it's really happening, the alternative media. More bad news for big media. This coming from a blog called Magic Thies, MIJIKTHISE. typepad.com. Viacom hired CIA torture team leader for the Kite Runner movie. So a retired CIA agent who led the team that waterboarded terror suspect Abu Zubaydah, which we all went over last week, went on to work as a security consultant for the film adaptation of Kite Runner. Lobbyists for Viacom helped the producers of the film retain retired CIA agent and quote-unquote counterterrorism expert John Kirkow, according to an October 4th article in the International Herald Tribune, IHT.com. The producers of Kite Runner realized belatedly that the film's release might put the movie's child stars in serious danger. In late July, with violence worsening in Kabul, studio executives looked for experts who could help them chart a safe course. Aided by lobbyists for Viacom, Paramount's parent company, they found John Kirkow, the retired CIA operative with experience in the region, and had him conduct interviews in Washington and Kabul. They wanted to do the right thing, but they wanted to understand what the right thing was, Kirikou said. And the article goes on to talk about Kite Runner and the adaptation of the Khalid Husseini novel that I see everyone on the bus reading. So there you go. Viacom hiring a CIA torturer. There is an ABC News report. The CIA efforts to prosecute this quote-unquote whistleblower were stopped. This is The Blotter, again from ABC, the former CIA intelligence official who went public on ABC News about the agency's use of waterboarding in interrogations, John Curacao, apparently will not be the subject of a Justice Department investigation, even though some CIA officials believed he revealed classified information about the use of waterboarding. They were furious at the CIA this morning, but cooler heads have apparently prevailed for the time being, a senior Justice Department official told the blotter on ABCNews.com. General Michael V. Hayden, the CIA director, did send out a classified memo warning all employees of the importance of protecting classified information. And all that's there, and you can read more and more about that. And of course, it all ties in with the destruction of the torture tapes. And it's just the latest scandal in another week in fascist America. Let's talk about the shock doctrine. As I mentioned last week, Naomi Klein, author of the new book, The Shock Doctrine, and of course the seminal No Logo, she was in Portland last week at the First Unitarian Church. I didn't end up going because I was tired. But fortunately, up on portland.indymedia.org, Joe Lockhart at philosophersseed.org, who has posted up a lot of good audio that happens in Portland, posted up the Naomi Klein talk in the overflow crowd, and there's some photos that you can see. It's not very often that you see someone giving a speech and you can see the crowd actually even behind them as well. So there were tons of people. Naomi Klein also went on Press Watch, which is the great show on KBOO here in Portland, KBOO.FM. On the show Press Watch, and I've played clips of that before. Teresa Mitchell, when he had Captain Eric May, when we were trying to figure out what the hell was going on with Noble Resolve. So here's a clip, double shot. It's Naomi Klein on KBOO, and then Naomi Klein speaking in Portland last Friday.
The radio station is KBOO Portland, 90.7 in Portland, other frequencies elsewhere, KBOO.FM. The time is 9:41. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This baritone voice belongs to a transgendered woman, and I'm speaking with Naomi Klein, author of Shock Doctrine. The book makes a wonderful gestalt, as above, so below, sort of gestalt, and takes the history of American torture and American depatterning, as it's called, something that I had been familiar with and from a book that you mentioned, John D. Mark's work on the search for the Manchurian candidate. Ewan Cameron in Canada in the 50s and 60s, the origin of tabula rasa shock therapy, and you bring that bizarre phenomenon into focus and show how it affects how torture is applied today, and you also bring that into its context, torture as applied to attempt to enforce the shock doctrine. Could you talk more about Ewan Cameron, U.S. torture, U.S. shock doctrine, and its development?
Yeah, of course. Well, I suppose the origins for this book came out of my reporting in Iraq in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion. I was there at the end of Paul Bremer's tenure as U.S. envoy or viceroy, and I was writing an article for Harper's Magazine about how the attempt to harness shock and awe, the shock and awe military strike, to harness that to push through economic shock therapy had really backfired, and Iraqis had not been pliant and disoriented and obedient as had been planned and hoped for by the administration, and it had in fact organized and rebelled against the U.S. presence and resisted, and in the face of that resistance there was the emergence of a third shock, shocks to bodies, a shock of torture. And I was in Iraq in this period when the first stories were coming out of Abu Ghraib, and then the photographs. So I came back from Iraq. I wrote this article for Harper's Magazine called Baghdad Year Zero, which was really about this dream at the highest reaches of the Bush administration that somehow by using this terrible violence, by shocking and awing this country, they would somehow blank the slate and be able to start over and build a model country in the rubble. And so I really wanted to understand what the logic was behind this idea of shocking into blankness, is the only way I can describe it, of blasting into blankness. In fact, I almost called the book Blasted Blank, or Blank is Beautiful, were a couple of my working titles. Because when I was in Iraq, you know, you compare the reality to the dream, you know, and this dream was use violence, blast this country, and then start over. But when you're there, you look around and all you see is rubble. All you see is destruction, and you realize how very confused the architects of this war are to confuse such terrible destruction with creation. And when you blast a country, it doesn't become clean and blank. It just is destroyed and confused and it's rubble, not blankness, that surrounds you. So when I got back, I wanted to understand this logic better, and somehow I ended up reading the declassified CIA interrogation manuals that were written in the 60s and based on the MKUltra experiments that you were referring to earlier. And that brought me to the work of Ewan Cameron at McGill University, because the manuals make reference to the McGill experiments. Ewan Cameron was head of psychiatry at McGill University in the late 50s and early 60s, and his work ended up being funded by the CIA. And he had a philosophy of how to use shock on his patients' minds that was very, very similar to this idea of using shock on countries to remake them. Cameron thought that if he used these massive doses of electroshock and also LSD and PCP and all of these experimental drugs, that he would blast his patients' minds into a blank slate, and then he could reprogram them. So the book explores these parallels between the psychology of shock therapy and the reality of shocks to countries and shocks to economies, and tries to understand why this very dangerous metaphor, this very dangerous fantasy, governs so many aspects of our life, from military to economics to psychiatry.
Sort of, it seems to describe an attempt to perform the equivalent of genocide on thoughts to achieve that blankness. And as you point out,
certainly memory. I mean, it's very important for people to understand that the enemy of the shock therapist, whether in Iraq or in the minds of these individuals, it's memory.
From the memory hole to the memory bomb.
Shock. You know, we use the phrase fairly lightly. We say we're in a state of shock. We don't really describe what that means. A shock is a response to an event that we can't assimilate. It's an event that seems to come out of nowhere, and it is a rupture in our story. Now, that can be on an individual level. It can be a terrible loss that surprises us and shocks us, and we lose our narrative. We lose a sense of who we are in the world, and we've all seen that, and many of us have experienced that directly. We know that state of shock. It can also happen to us collectively, and many of these events that I'm describing, a hurricane like Katrina, or the tsunami, or a war like a shock and awe attack, or September 11th, what they represent are events that are too big to be assimilated into a national narrative. And the phrase blowback is really important to understand in this context. 9/11 was a classic case of blowback. And what makes it a classic case of blowback is blowback is a CIA term, as you know, as Chalmers Johnson has explained, to describe the repercussions of actions that the U.S. government took, but that were covert actions. I.e. actions that people didn't know about by their very nature. They were covert. So when there is blowback from those actions, when there are ramifications from those actions, they seem to come out of nowhere because there isn't a context in which to place them. So the ramifications from those actions are particularly shocking. They are particularly surprising. So if we think about the collective responses to 9/11, it came from nowhere. Why do they hate us? Who are these people? It was the feelings of classic disorientation, an event that seemed to come out of nowhere. So shock is the gap that opens up between an event and our collective story. And our collective story is our history, right? It is the gap that opens up between our collective narrative. And when that gap opens up, we are very, very vulnerable.
That's Naomi Klein speaking last week, December 7th, in Portland, Oregon, and you can get the whole hour of her talk up on MediaMonarchy.com. And you're into, we are well into, hour number two of episode 54 of Media Monarchy. It's December 14th, 2007, coming to you live from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and also from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info, and you can hit me up on myspace.com/MediaMonarchy. Send me an email, MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com, and you can get the podcast anytime thanks to iTunes or RadioForAll.net or archive.org. Jumping quickly and looking at some of the breaking news that's coming out at the moment, a couple things from Raw Story. They've got a graphic account of a Blackwater massacre, and we're going to get a little bit into Blackwater on this show. And also, Bush's document shredding is in high gear. Halfway through 2007, the Bush administration topped $2.9 million spent in shredding documents. How do you like that? Our next story coming from the Associated Press. This, of course, about the pharmacy industrial complex and Merck and the Centers for Disease Creation, Control. Merck children's vaccine recalled, over a million doses recalled. A common vaccine given to babies as young as 2 months was being recalled Wednesday because of contamination risks. But the top U.S. health official said it was not a health threat. The recall is for 1.2 million doses of the vaccine for Hib, which protects against meningitis, pneumonia, and other serious infections, and a combination vaccine for Hib and hepatitis B. The vaccine is recommended for all children under 5 and is usually given in 3-shot series starting at 2 months. Drug maker Merck and Company, which announced the recall after testing showed sterilization problem in a Pennsylvania factory, said that concerned parents should contact their children's doctor. The potential for contamination of any individual vaccine is low, said Merck spokeswoman Kelly Doherty. But Dr. Julie Gerberding, head of the Centers for Disease Creation, echoed that in a newscast, "This is not a health threat in the short run, but it is an inconvenience." Yes, nasty, tainted vaccines that you give your children are certainly an inconvenience. I also have linked up where you can go down the hole and read about Merck and the pharmaceutical industry, Merck, of course, being a originally German company. Jumping back to Press TV, Iran abandons the dollar in the oil deals. This is a short story, but of monumental importance as we watch our dollar die. Iran has completely stopped carrying out its oil deals in the U.S. dollar following the OPEC proposal to trade crude in non-dollar currencies. Quote, "The dollar is no longer a reliable currency considering its devaluation and the loss suffered by oil exporters." And that was, of course, said by Iranian oil minister Gholam Hossein Nozari. Iran proposed in the last OPEC, that is Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in the last OPEC summit that member states use a reliable currency in their oil transactions to prevent further losses. Also adding that the organization will come to a decision on the issue in the Vienna meeting on February 2nd. Meanwhile, the organization decided to keep oil output unchanged at the Abu Dhabi summit on December 5th, arguing that there was enough oil in the market to meet the winter fuel demand. Now, phony terror. It's the Sears Tower bomb plot. It's the latest batch of duped, retarded, useful idiot, patsy, provocateur, informant, phony terror groups. So the latest, this coming from the BBC, the Chicago bomb defendant is cleared. A jury in Miami has cleared one man of trying to blow up America's tallest building, the Sears Tower in Chicago, as part of a holy war. The jury was unable to reach a verdict on the 6 other defendants, and the judge declared a mistrial. Prosecutors say they plan to try them again next year. As, of course, it seems like double jeopardy is gone with a lot of the other Bill of Rights amendments. The defendants were known as, of course, the Liberty City 7, after the poor area of Miami that they lived in, that they operated in. The acquitted man, Ligelson Lamorin, buried his face in his hands when the verdict came in. The government had presented the arrests of the defendants as an important victory in its war on terror. They faced up to 70 years in jail after facing charges on 4 counts, including taking an oath of allegiance to Al-Qaeda. The prosecution said they had hoped to forge an alliance with Al-Qaeda to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago and FBI offices in Miami and elsewhere, but they succeeded only in contacting a, what, paid FBI informant. And the defense argued that they were, in fact, hapless figures who were either entrapped by the FBI or went along with the plot in order to con the FBI informant out of $50,000. It said they wanted money to transform the warehouse in Liberty City where they met into a community gathering place. Even the government described the alleged plot as, quote, more aspirational than operational. Big surprise. Now, Lee Rogers over at RogueGovernment.com has the report Liberty City 7 shows terror war is a fraud. And he throws out some quotes from the AP article covering the event. But jumping down to the bottom, the deadlocked jury combined with admitted statements from the federal government is obvious proof that there was no terror threat from the Liberty City 7 and that this whole situation was provoked by the FBI. Other incidents, like the Fort Dix 6, raise additional questions about the federal government's credibility on the subject of this phony war on terrorism. The war on terror isn't real, and if it was the government who wouldn't... The government wouldn't need to send FBI informants to entrap a group of crazy people hanging out in a warehouse. That's kind of a glib take, but it's true. Jumping back to June 23, 2006, when this story broke, Raw Story BBC, they of course say that the Sears Tower plotters were just wannabes. And the BBC and the Miami Herald reported that the government's arrest of seven men in connection with a plot to blow up the Sears Tower is probably overblown. They've been described to us by sources as wannabes. In addition to all this is, of course, the link to the Wikipedia entry of the 2006 Sears Tower plot, and you can read all about that. It's also important to note that the same people who bought the World Trade Center bought the Sears Tower. And it's also important to note, once again, like in much of these cases, there's always some kind of informant.
On Forward Tonight, new information on the case against the so-called Liberty City 7. We are learning more about one of the people who went to the FBI, alerting them the alleged ringleader had hooked up with an Al-Qaeda operative. Only the FBI already knew because that operative was one of their own informants. Our own Brian Andrews has been on the case from the start. Brian, who is this guy we're now hearing more about?
Well, Joy, this is a guy who we first met outside the FBI the very night the government made arrests in the case. He's a Moses-like figure who wears dark sunglasses and often carries a wooden staff on his visits to the courthouse. On that night, he passed himself off as just a friend of the group's alleged ringleader. But since then, we've learned the government believes he was much more involved.
Master G.J.G. Athia, as he calls himself, was identified by the FBI as a target in the case early on. Agents learned he was the spiritual father of alleged ringleader Narcile Batiste. Athia was picked up on wiretap saying he was joining forces with Batiste in his mission to create a Moorish nation. In late March, Batiste tells Athia in an intercepted phone call how excited he was to know that a cruise ship had caught fire. Athia tells Batiste, "That ain't nothing compared to what divine father got laid up for us," suggesting he may have known about Batiste's plans to blow up the Sears Tower. In April, the government continues monitoring Athia and generates intelligence suggesting he's a ranking member of the group. By late May, the FBI says he's no longer a target. He's now working as an informant. Documents say Athia met with Batiste in an undercover capacity at the direction of the FBI, but that agents stopped using him because Athia's relationship with Batiste is strained. How did that happen? Well, on April 19th at the group's Liberty City Embassy, another potential witness in the case, a Moorish temple leader named Sultan Kanbay, was arrested by the Miami police for firing off a shot at Athia during an argument. Days earlier, Kanbay held a trial at the embassy, accusing Batiste of treason and insubordination under Moorish law. He said Batiste's carelessness had opened the group to FBI surveillance and was angry Batiste had brought in a man passing himself off as one of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda operatives in an effort to get money for their religious cause. Batiste was then kicked out of the temple, and the group started falling apart, with only a few people siding with Batiste, including Athia. On April 27th, Master G.J.G. Athia went to the FBI with news of a possible terrorist threat against the U.S. He told agents that Batiste had formed a dangerous alliance with an Arabian mafia to provide weapons and other resources for a terror attack. On May 16th, the FBI sent Athia to meet with Batiste. During that meeting, which was recorded, Batiste told Athia that he never said he had acquired weapons from his association with the Arabian Mafia, but that he was told they could provide any resources he needed to help him complete his mission.
Master GJG Athia declined to talk to me on camera about his involvement in the case. Now, after reviewing what's been filed with the court and turned over to the defense, this case certainly reads like a Carl Hyacin novel.
You're back on MediaMonarchy.com, episode 54, December 14th, 2007. That was an older clip when this provocateur case of the Liberty City 7 was breaking. And all that info is up there for you on MediaMonarchy.com. Moving quickly ahead, there's a ridiculous editorial posted on Investors Business Daily. Would Democrats waterboard Atta? The question above, assuming we had 9/11 mastermind Mohammed Atta in custody on 9/10, is what those grilling the director of the CIA would ask. So, basically, not only is this all posed in the phony left-right paradigm, but it also plays into all the phony Jack Bauer 24 bullshit of having that terrorist right before some event, and would you torture him in situations that really probably will never happen. Why I posted this up, and what makes it interesting, is that, you know, he poses this question of, oh, well, you know, would you have waterboarded Atta if we had him before 9/11? We did have him before 9/11. And we know that because of something called Able Danger, a classified military intelligence program under the command of the U.S. Special Operations Command. It was created as a result of a directive from the Joint Chiefs of Staff in early October 99 by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hugh Shelton, to develop an information operations campaign plan against transnational terrorism. We've gone over Able Danger on this show before, and it's always worth going over again. And I've got a couple clips on how this all ties into Mohammed Atta and ex-Congressman Kurt Weldon and all the foreknowledge of 9/11.
A Senate panel today tried to get to the bottom of a now-defunct Pentagon project called Able Danger, and the question of whether that project identified 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta long before he participated in the deadly attacks in 2001. But as Fox News correspondent Catherine Herridge reports, today's Judiciary Committee hearing was clouded from the start.
Senate Judiciary Chairman Arlen Specter said the Defense Department may be obstructing his committee's investigation of Able Danger because the department would not authorize the testimony of five key witnesses.
I think the Department of Defense owes the American people an explanation as to what went on here. There are very credible questions which have been raised.
Two members of Able Danger barred from testifying, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and defense contractor J.D. Smith, sat silently as Congressman Kurt Weldon spoke on their behalf, claiming that both men said the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, was identified by the Secret Military Intelligence Unit as a security threat more than 1 year before 9/11. The Republican from Pennsylvania first made the claims on the House floor this summer.
Over the past 3 months, I have witnessed denial, deception, threats to DOD employees, character assassination, and now silence.
A senior Democrat on the committee pointed out that Able Danger began in 99 and was shut down in 2001.
The part that quite frankly confuses the devil out of me as I try to figure this out, Mr. Chairman, this started in the Clinton administration. It morphed into, or it leached into the beginning of the Bush administration. It's not like there's an attempt to nail politically anybody here.
Only one witness who testified today had direct knowledge of Able Danger. Eric Kleinsmith said he was instructed to destroy data because of strict military rules governing the collection of information on U.S. citizens and legal residents inside the country.
So all, both soft copy and hard copy, was deleted or destroyed.
Asked if he believed the claims of Schaefer, Smith, and Navy Captain Scott Philpott, seen here on the right, that Otto was identified on their charts, Kleinsmith said he took them at their word.
Because I myself do not remember seeing either a picture or his name on any charts. But I believe them implicitly. When they say they do, I believe them.
The Pentagon did provide one witness who said information could be held for 90 days, and if it did not meet specific criteria, it had to be destroyed.
But in 1999-2000, I guess I wish to convey to the committee that U.S. person information is something that we are skittish about, in the Defense Department?
And late today, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld refuted allegations his department was not fully cooperating, saying the department had offered the committee a classified briefing, but they had preferred an open hearing. Senator Spector suggested today more hearings may now be necessary to get to the bottom of the Able Danger controversy. In Washington, Catherine Herridge, Fox News.
Turning now to the issue of national security, my guest tonight has created a firestorm in Washington over what he says is a cover-up of vital pre-9/11 intelligence. It is the highly classified Able Danger program. And it identified Mohammed Atta and three other 9/11 terrorists as members of an Al-Qaeda cell in Brooklyn, New York, more than a year before the attacks. Congressman Kurt Weldon says the man who blew the whistle on this intelligence, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaffer, is now the subject of a smear campaign by the Defense Intelligence Agency. Congressman Weldon blasted the DIA in a fiery speech on the House floor just last night.
This is an attempt to prevent the American people from knowing the facts about how we could have prevented 9/11, and people are covering it up today. And they're ruining the career of a military officer to do it. And we can't let it stand. I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican. You can't let a lieutenant colonel's career be ruined because of some bureaucrat in the Defense Intelligence Agency. If we let that happen, then no one that wears the uniform will ever feel protected. Because we will have let them down.
Congressman Weldon joins us now from Capitol Hill. Congressman, what prompted your call for an immediate investigation?
Lou, this is so outrageous it makes me sick to my stomach. As a loyal member of the Armed Services Committee supporting our military for 19 years, the intelligence agency took away Tony Schaefer's security clearance. They're now about to take away his health care benefits. He has two children and his salary because he told the truth. When they took away his security clearance, they said in September 23rd in a letter, you can never see any classified information or documents again. Over the weekend, they sent this box, Lou, labeled Defense Intelligence Agency, to his home. In the box were five classified documents. They sent five classified documents mistakenly to Tony Schaefer at his home. The Defense Intelligence Agency is on a witch hunt. They accused him of stealing pens.
Congressman,
this is outrageous.
Why would the Defense Intelligence Agency want to destroy the reputation, as you point out, a decorated career member of the United States military?
Lou, when the story is told, when the Able Danger story comes out, there's going to be embarrassment all over the place. The Defense Intelligence Agency, spending hundreds of millions of dollars, could not do what a 20-member special team did in identifying, through data mining, Mohammed Atta and the Brooklyn cell 1 year before 9/11. Those DIA officials are still in the agency. They're still there working. And they don't want Tony Schaefer to tell the truth. They don't want Commander Scott Philpott to tell the truth, because they're then going to have to answer the question, why did you ignore this? Why did you not take appropriate steps? Why did this information not be passed to the FBI? Louis Free this past Sunday said on Meet the Press that if he'd had the Able Danger information, the FBI could have stopped the hijackings. That's Louis Free saying that this past Sunday.
And to be clear, the suggestion is that the Pentagon stopped Able Danger from sharing that information with the FBI or any other agency that might have acted. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It was September of 2000 when it was stopped.
Now, the 9/11 Commission at first denied that Able Danger existed, that they had been told anything about this. That was the first remark from Lee Hamilton. It was the first response from the staff. Subsequently, it turned out that, yes, they had heard about Able Danger on two occasions. How do you feel about the commission and its reaction to Able Danger and the allegations that have been made?
Well, Lou, I supported the commission when it was established. I know some of the commissioners. I'm convinced the commissioners themselves were never briefed. But what I have found out is that Scott Philpott, an Annapolis grad, who voluntarily went in and briefed a 9/11 commission staffer in July of 2004, told the 9/11 Commission staffer about Able Danger. That 9/11 Commission staffer made a decision not to brief the commissioners. That 9/11 Commission staffer was working for Jamie Gorelick, who was a member of the commission who wrote the famous memo that said they could not transfer information between the military and the FBI.
the so-called wall.
Yes.
Congressman Kurt Weldon, we thank you for being here. We're going to follow this carefully, as are you. We would like you to come back with every development, and we will continue to follow this rigorously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman, and thank you for your concern on the issue.
There's a couple old clips about Able Danger. I brought a lot of info with me to go into Able Danger, but I don't really have the time now, but I implore you to do that. And it's all up there on MediaMonarchy.com. Jumping now to an editorial by ex-CIA agent Robert Baer, who we're going to hear a clip from in just a few minutes. He has an editorial up on Time.com called "The CIA's Gift to Conspiracy Theorists." The CIA has proved once again that the cover-up is worse than the crime, or at least let's hope that's the case. CIA Director Hayden has admitted that in 2005, the CIA destroyed two videotapes of interrogations of al-Qaeda prisoners, including a central figure in 9/11, Abu Zubaydah. Hayden said the tapes were destroyed to protect the identities of the interrogators from members of al-Qaeda and other terrorists who might try to retaliate. At a time when congressional Democrats are trying once again to pass a torture ban, it's a given that the revelation is going to further inflame the torture debate, since the tapes apparently showed harsh interrogation techniques. The assumption will be that the CIA did not want the tapes to be seen in public because they are too graphic and could lead to indictments. But more to the point, the revelation will raise another question: what other evidence has the CIA destroyed? And can the CIA be trusted to tell us? They told the 9/11 Commission when it formally requested such materials there was no taping of interrogations. CIA lawyers also told federal prosecutors trying the Zacharias Moussaoui terror case that the agency didn't possess recordings of interrogations sought by the judge and Moussaoui's defense lawyers. The CIA insists that the tapes destroyed were not those in question. I find it very difficult to believe the CIA would deliberately destroy evidence material to the 9/11 investigation, evidence that would cover up a core truth, such as who was really behind 9/11. On the other hand, I have to wonder what space-time continuum the CIA exists in if they weren't able to grasp what a field day the 9/11 conspiracy theorists are going to have with this, especially at a time when trust for the government is plumbing new depths. I myself have felt the pull of the conspiracy theorists who believe that 9/11 was an inside job somehow pulled off for the U.S. government. For the record, he goes on to state that he doesn't believe that it was brought down by explosives or any of that. Some have speculated, perhaps, that Robert Baer is some sort of CIA disinfo agent. His book, See No Evil, was turned into the Academy Award-winning Syriana. An accompanying article to the clip we're about to hear with Robert Baer, where he suggests that the Saudis could stage terror in America to instigate an Iran attack. Former CIA veteran Robert Baer has suggested that a withdrawal from the possibility of striking Iran could be reversed if a terror attack was to take place in America, and he fingered America's ally Saudi Arabia as the most likely perpetrator of any such attack. Baer also questioned why the U.S. and its allies continue to protect individuals who consorted with the alleged mastermind of 9/11 before the attacks. Baer was labeled perhaps the best on-the-ground field officer in the Middle East by the venerable Seymour Hersh, and his astounding career formed the script for the Academy Award-winning movie Syriana.
Oh, I think we're definitely in it. I mean, you know, search and seizure, you don't need a warrant anymore. We know that. Every day we're being warned there's going to be an attack, and there isn't one. And so much information is being kept from us. I mean, Bush said that he just found out about this Iranian stuff last week. Well, that's nonsense. You don't find this stuff out from, apparently it's from telephone intercepts, and don't tell the president. You can't have a government that's fundamentally dishonest with the American people and then change the laws and not have people lose confidence, as both the Republicans and the Democrats have. Climate's terrible.
Well, I've been watching even diplomatic programs where on C-SPAN, where the diplomats are admitting that the U.S. has never lost its soft power like it has now. They're talking about it being gone, Robert.
Oh, I think it is. I think the world's changed. The world has completely changed, and you get used to it. We are quickly losing our power and our ability and our moral ascendancy as well, which we depended upon and which did us so well for so many years.
Did they use daily and weekly terror alerts? I mean, they've admitted they have, but your take on them using it as a political tool and really blowing their credibility, or is that an accurate statement?
No, they've blown their credibility. I mean, you know, we got the president talking in October about World War III with Iran, and then in the course of 6 weeks, it's completely changed and say that it's a benign power, Iran, let's not worry about it.
What would happen if there was a precipitous event in the next few months, a terror attack, or one of our interests was hit? I mean, do you think Iran would do something like that and bring the wrath of the U.S. in, or do you think somebody else would do something?
I think they've already won. I'm writing a book on Iran, and I think they've won. I mean, I just think we're going to be facing a new Tehran, and we better not hope they're as malicious as they claim to be.
But you say Iran has won, Pax Americana, Anglo-American, U.S.-Israel, England has lost. Couldn't somebody in the neocon camp stage a provocateur or allow something to happen to get us back in the game?
Yeah, I mean, the only way you're going to get back in the game is if we reimpose the draft. We put 1 million soldiers in Iraq, in the Gulf. That's the only way we get back in the game.
But if there was another terror attack, couldn't that be the...
That's the only way you're going to do it. Otherwise, Americans, what do you mean we're spending $1 trillion a year in Iraq?
Well, let's be clear. You're saying without another terror attack, the agenda to invade or attack Iran is dead.
Absolutely.
So who would launch that terror attack?
Well, use your imagination. Whose interest is it in? It's in Saudi Arabia's interest, for instance.
Because they're enemies with Iran.
Yeah, so who's going to protect them against Iran unless there's an attack in this country?
I never thought of that. Started a war against Islamofascism to aim them at Iran.
Yeah, that's what exactly the Gulf countries want us to do, is go to war with Iran.
Amazing.
That's Robert Baer last week on the Alex Jones Show. While I was doing this show, MediaMonarchy.com, trying to speed through things, but we're still staying on the topic of the, of course, National Intelligence Estimate and Iran and torture, and we're going to go down a little uglier hole of torture and rape and videotape. And right now, former CIA agent again, another one, this guy, Larry Johnson, a former CIA agent and State Department counterterrorism official, told the Bill Press Show a few days ago that it was highly likely President Bush had viewed the videotapes of the 2002 interrogations that were later destroyed.
Now, you said you think, you believe, that President Bush himself actually saw one of these videos?
I think it's highly likely.
That's what I said. And I, of course, made the joke last week that, you know, they would masturbate to them, but... Every joke is rooted in a little bit of truth. So, once again, to Press TV, U.S. covering up Kellogg Brown and Root rape case. A former employee of the U.S. Halliburton KBR construction firm has accused Washington of covering up her rape by colleagues in Iraq. Jamie Lee Jones, 22, was gang raped by her co-workers 2 years ago at a KBR camp in the Green Zone, a heavily guarded area in central Baghdad where U.S. officials live and work, ABC reported. According to Jamie Lee Jones, she was drugged, imprisoned in a shipping container without food or water for at least 24 hours, and injured both physically and emotionally. Jones said her captors warned her not to leave Iraq for medical treatment. And the ABC report that it mentioned is also posted up. Houston, Texas woman says she was gang raped by Halliburton KBR co-workers in Baghdad, and the company and the U.S. government are covering up the incident. Now, that's disturbing, and it sends us back to, of course, Seymour Hersh's report from a couple years ago. This came out in 2004 when the Abu Ghraib prison scandal was breaking. This coming from CommonDreams.org. There were new claims of serious abuses at Abu Ghraib. Dateline Washington, leading investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has told the American Civil Liberties Union that videotapes were made of young boys being sodomized at Abu Ghraib prison. The Bush administration is holding videotapes of these acts, said Hersh, who's a regular contributor to The New Yorker and other publications, and who spoke at the ACLU's annual membership conference. And again, this is in 2004, and a video of that presentation, I believe, is available somewhere out there, but I don't have it linked up. Now, we heard about Lee Hamilton and the 9/11 Commission when we were hearing Kurt Weldon talk about the CIA and the 9/11 Commission, so... Coming from DePaul University, there's a larger report, and it ties into the Detroit Free Press and also reports from the International Herald Tribune. But the headline is that Lee Hamilton says that the CIA obstructed the 9/11 Commission. Quote, did they obstruct our inquiry? The answer is clearly yes, says Lee Hamilton, who co-chaired the 9/11 Commission. In the wake of reports, the CIA destroyed videotapes of interrogations of two Al-Qaeda suspects. Whether that amounts to a crime, others will have to judge, adds Hamilton, a 1952 graduate of DePaul University, where this report's coming from, and, like I said, also in the Detroit Free Press. And once again, all those links are there, and you can see how that isn't exactly new news, that Hamilton and Keene have both said that they were lied to and obstructed when they were trying to do their phony whitewash 9/11 Commission report. They even said it in their book, Without Precedent. Jumping now to military.com, military family poll, war not worth it. Cincinnati Post, Dateline Washington. Families with ties to the military, long a reliable source of support for wartime presidents, disapprove of President Bush and his handling of the war in Iraq, with a majority concluding the invasion was not worth it. An LA Times Bloomberg poll has found. That link's there. You can look at all the charts and graphs and questions and things. Moving, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we were going to touch quickly on the Krongard brothers. That would be Buzzy and Cookie. But first, the McClatchy report, embattled State Department Inspector General resigns. Dateline Washington, this is last Friday, embattled State Department Inspector General Howard Cookie Krongard, submitted his resignation Friday, forced out for allegedly impeding an ongoing criminal investigation into the construction of a new $740 million U.S. embassy in Baghdad and security firm Blackwater Worldwide. A State Department official said that Krongard had become a political liability, and Condi Rice, through aides, asked him to quit. The official insisted on anonymity because blah-bitty-blah. An abrasive attorney who once reportedly referred to himself as an equal opportunity abuser, Krongard came under fire from his own investigators from a congressional panel for allegedly blocking probes into serious claims of wrongdoing in Iraq. Those allegations include contract fraud and shoddy workmanship in the troubled Baghdad embassy and arms smuggling by Blackwater. And of course, you know, they're just ugly rumors. Krongard initially vowed to fight the accusations against him, but his position collapsed at a House of Representatives hearing last month when he was asked whether his brother, former top CIA official Alvin Buzzy Krongard, had accepted a position on Blackwater Advisory Board. Krongard first announced what he said were ugly rumors, then, after telephoning his brother, reversed himself. Now, linked up in this story, in addition to the Washington Post report of the same event, Howard J. Krongard, the State Department's embattled inspector general, announced that he is stepping down. And, of course, the arms running and Condi Rice and Blackwater and all of that. What's interesting to investigate, and fun, too, is to go way back to just after 9/11. And one of the classic reports comes from Michael Rupert and from thewilderness.com and also his book, Crossing the Rubicon. Suppressed details of criminal insider trading lead directly into the CIA's highest rank. That would be insider trading before 9/11. When they looked it up, it led back to Buzzy Krongard, CIA executive director. He managed a firm that handled those put options that were put on United Airlines. You remember the ridiculously high put options, the bets that the stock was going to fall. When that was investigated, it headed back to Buzzy Krongard and the CIA. So just a quick clip from the Michael Rupert article. Although uniformly ignored by the mainstream U.S. media, there is abundant and clear evidence that a number of transactions in financial markets indicated specific criminal foreknowledge of 9/11. In the case of at least one of these trades, which has left a $2.5 million prize unclaimed, the firm used to place the put options on United Airlines stock was, until 98, managed by the man who is now in the number 3 executive director position at the CIA. Until 97, A.B. Buzzy Krongard had been chairman of the investment bank A.B. Brown. A.B. Brown was acquired by Bankers Trust in 97. Krongard then became, as part of the merger, vice chairman of Bankers Trust A.B. Brown, one of the 20 major U.S. banks named by Senator Carl Levin as being connected to money laundering. And of course, that ties into money laundering and drug money and arms running and all the things that our friends and spooks in the CIA are old pros at. Let's close it out with a couple positive things and the latest on the only candidate that can beat Hillary Clinton. That's Ron Paul, 2008.com. A couple reports. Let's see how he deals with, or rather the other way around. Let's see how Rudy Giuliani deals with a little Ron Paul escort.
Inside the Carrick House, a lavish fundraiser to raise money for Rudy Giuliani. Outside, they're raising their voices.
Change the direction the war's going.
To show Rudy Giuliani where the heart of American people really lies.
The Ron Paul people are all over the country.
They are
all over the country. They're very, obviously very enthusiastic. They have a very singular view, and it's a very different viewpoint than the viewpoint that I have.
Lately, Giuliani can't go anywhere without Paul's people showing up.
I disagree with him on a number of things, from gun control to fiscal policy.
The New York mayor's visit to Kentucky is in part to prove to conservatives he's their man.
I'm the strongest fiscal conservative in this race. I've lowered taxes many more times than any other people running.
It's been a tough sell. He's moderate by Kentucky standards on issues like gay rights and abortion.
I do believe that women have to have an ability to have government not make that decision.
But for the crowd outside, the issue is Iraq. Giuliani makes no apologies for his strong support of the war.
We're confronted with a terrorist war against us.
It's one of his major themes at fundraisers here in Lexington and across the country. And even though Kentucky won't hold the primary until the nomination is solidified,
it's important to lay the groundwork, you know, for a campaign that's going, in my view, be a 50-state campaign.
Rudy Giuliani is confident there will be a reason to return. Naysayers say they'll be back as well.
That's an ABC 36 report, WTVQ, out of the aforementioned Kentucky, where poor old 9/11 criminal Rudolph Giuliani has Ron Paul detractors than actual supporters. Of course, you should try and look at how many meetup groups he has. Our last thing, coming from ABC News, John Stossel interviewed Ron Paul, and they talked about personal freedom, drugs, prostitution, and gay marriage. The interesting thing is, ABC News didn't run it on TV. They did the cop-out and said, well, since Ron Paul's support is all on the internet, it only makes sense that we, you know, just post the interview on the internet. So let's see what old Stossel says.
Freedom of choice, says presidential candidate Ron Paul, shouldn't just be restricted to choices he approves of. He opposes things like prostitution and drug use, but says the federal government has no business trying to stop adults from doing them.
You would legalize marijuana, cocaine, heroin?
I would get the government out of regulating all those substances, and I would allow the states to deal with problems, whether children should have them, whether children can buy cigarettes and alcohol or hard drugs, marijuana, and different states would probably do different things. The first federal law against marijuana was 1938, and they did it through high taxation because they knew they didn't have authority to say that you're not allowed to smoke marijuana. Today, it's gone berserk. The federal government comes in and overrules a state that has legalized marijuana to be used for very sick people, like AIDS and cancer, and they're getting some help. The federal government comes in, puts people in prison that are sick because they're using it for medical reasons, and they've never committed a violent crime. That's how absurd the war on drugs has become.
Alcohol prohibition led to more crime. You Absolutely. Argue that even heroin could be legal if some state decided, wouldn't?
I think under our system of government that would be the case. But if you ask the people who are against it, if a state did that, would you use it? They say, oh, no, I wouldn't use it. It's always those other people that might use it, so I have to take care of them and prevent them from doing harm to themselves.
What about that? Is that a role for government?
No, I don't believe so. I think the government's role should not be involved in personal habits. I believe those rules should protect children who are below the age of making good judgments. So I have no problem with state laws that would protect children from the use of these drugs. But under the Constitution, the president and the federal government wouldn't have a say in it.
Homosexuality. Should gays be allowed to marry?
Sure.
The state says we believe in this?
Sure, they can do whatever they want, and they can call it whatever they want, just so they don't expect to impose their relationship on somebody else. They can't make me personally accept what they do, but they can. Gay couples can do whatever they want. Matter of fact, I'd like to see all governments out of the marriage question. I don't think it's a state function. I think it's a religious function. And there was a time when only churches dealt with, you know, marriage, and they determined what it was. But 100 years or so ago, for health reasons, they claimed that the state would protect us if we knew more about our spouses and we did health testing and you had to get a license to get married. And I don't agree with that.
Prostitution.
I think when you defend freedom, you defend freedom of choice, and you can't be picking and choosing how people use those freedoms. So if they do things that you don't like and you might find morally repugnant, I, as an individual, I don't make that judgment. So I don't believe government can legislate virtue. I can reject it personally and preach against it, whether it's drugs or prostitution, but my solution comes from my personal behavior with myself and how I raise my children. But whether it's personal behavior or economic behavior, I want people to have freedom of choice.
Adults, you seem to be saying, own their own bodies, and if a woman wants to rent hers out, that's her business. If she wants or he wants to smoke crack,
yeah, I think it's tragic, and matter of fact, I think the war on drugs, which has caused the price of drugs to go up, and we treat them as criminals rather than sick people, we have pushed a lot of people into prostitution. So prostitution is related to the mistakes we've made in the drug war. But you know, I think people, you know, make bad choices in religion and philosophy, but we don't regulate their thinking or their religious beliefs that they're not harming other people. That's why I defend this position that individuals should protect themselves. Governments can't protect individuals from themselves. It's just impossible. Otherwise, they become a tyrannical state.
That's ABC News' John Stossel with their internet-only interview with Ron Paul. And what I don't have time to get into is, of course, all the debates now have wrapped up. And so there are some good clips of Ron Paul at the final Republican debate that you can check out online, ronpaul2008.com. But that's going to do it for this 54th episode of Media Monarchy, December 14th, 2007. As I like to close out each show, is give you a little rundown of some of the creepy and interesting characters that visit MediaMonarchy.com throughout the week. This week, we had someone from Cleveland State University landed on MediaMonarchy.com after Googling Henry Rollins and Illuminati. The Sacramento County Office of Education Googled Homeland Security at Mall. The Navy Network Information Center, we're reading about how military officers were blamed in the Tillman cover-up on MediaMonarchy.com. The Barracuda Air Force Base Googled Brookings Institution O'Hanlon Cheyenne Mountain. And Thompson & Thompson, a trademark and copyright firm out of Quincy, Massachusetts. This is interesting. They Googled Media Monarchy or Media Monarch or Medium Monarch. So I'm wondering if somebody's trying to jack my Media Monarchy name. I got a copyright firm Googling it. Anyway, the West Virginia Department of Education Googled GIs of World War II, and they ended up reading, of course, about Chinese prostitutes, or rather, Japanese prostitutes. Interstate Hotels and Resorts Googled December 2007 mind control shootings. Al Jazeera International out of D.C. Googled John Curacao and Kite Runner and Viacom. South Dakota State Government Googled Father Morales, Bush, martial law. The Memphis Daily News hit me up from my link on orblogs.com about NBC giving refunds. Disney Worldwide Services Googled NBC refunds money. The state of Maryland hit me up off of blacklistednews.com to read about the Merck vaccine recall. The Department of Defense Network Information Center were back on MediaMonarchy.com reading again about Noble Resolve. Job Corps Data Center in Austin, Texas Googled open borders in a North American Union. Underwriters Laboratory in Durham, North Carolina Googled the Sears Tower plot. The Beale Air Force Base, 9th Communications Squadron, again from Blacklisted News and the Merck recall. The Marine Corps Community Services of Quantico, Virginia, and the Drug Enforcement Administration, as always, visiting MediaMonarchy.com. Of course, as Ron Paul just mentioned about the phony failed war on drugs. Another story that broke that I didn't get a chance to cover, maybe I'll get into it next week, is that a CIA torture jet crashed with what? Oh, hundreds of pounds of cocaine aboard. So yeah, look to see that on the front page of the New York Times. I don't think so. You're only going to get it here on MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and the Revere Radio Network, RevereRadio.info. Hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo, and get the podcasts, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. Please add a link to your MySpace page or share the show. Spread the word, and I'll keep doing it, and we'll keep doing it, and somehow we'll get through it as we close out 2007. So thanks for joining me. I appreciate it. My name's James. As always, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Thought police would get him just the same.